part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm here doing part. Fanboy.com.
How you doing, Phil?
I'm doing good, man. How are you doing?
Good. Just made it. Just made it. Oh, I'm so glad
thanks
to be here.
Thanks for doing that. Sorry, dude.
No.
I got like totally like scheduled up out the wazoo today for some reason.
No,
but,
I totally get it. And it's like, it was like a last minute, like, oh, hey, Dad, I have a Girl Scout meeting tomorrow. I was like, what? This was not on the calendar. Nobody put this on there. I was just like, And of course, we couldn't move it, but it's fine. It's fine. We're here now.
Yes. Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And anytime, Phil, you're like one of my favorite people to talk to. We both love horror movies. So I just love having you on. And I really enjoy your book. So thanks for joining me back on the podcast.
Pleasure. My pleasure.
Cool. Well, let's just start by saying that, well, my name is Christian Horn. This is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. We have a very special returning guest. This is kind of like, I think your third time on the podcast, right, Phil?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Phil Mucci, as in Gucci, right?
Correct.
That's how you instructed me the very first time we did our first interview. You were like, Mucci as in Gucci. Phil Mucci, you are on the podcast. You are returning because you have a Kickstarter currently on, and it is Professor Dario Bava, Orgy of the Blood Freaks. This is the second issue, right? But it's one and two on Kickstarter.
Yeah,
right?
we did the campaign as one and two because that seems to be like the way so that people don't feel like they're missing out, you know?
Yeah.
But it is our second book, and we're actually sold out of the first book. So we're also raising money to help pay for the reprint on book one.
Nice.
Because we want to do a whole nother run of that book because it was very popular. It was more popular than we thought.
Yeah, yeah.
When you first do a campaign, you kind of like, okay, we got this many people to pre-order. So how many more should we get? You know, like, well, our first book didn't. We're still selling some of those. And so you kind of come up with a number that you think you can manage.
Yeah.
Because we're not a big company. We don't go through Diamond as a distributor.
Yeah.
In which case you need to print thousands just for them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we're doing graphic novels, which are more expensive than your typical floppy comic.
Yeah.
Because they're perfect bound, they're bigger, they have more pages, you know, yada yada, and the pages are nicer. So it's always kind of a weird guessing game, you know. But we ended up selling out of that in less than a year, the first book.
That's
and
amazing.
Now we're like, oh, we don't have books to go to all these events we've got planned, and we're still working on book two.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, so, wow. That's great.
Yeah, it is kind of like encouraging because it feels like, okay, you know, maybe we're not totally crazy.
Yeah, yeah. You're doing something right for sure. I mean, one of the things that you do right is like you go to horror cons, right? It's not just comic conventions, right? Like you go to horror shows.
Correct.
And other things like that, like Monsterpalooza. And is that the one in Pasadena? Is that Monsterpalooza?
Monsterpalooza, we've done a couple of times, and their sort of son of Monsterpalooza, in Burbank. We're doing that one coming up in October.
I've never been to either one, and I just need to go to one someday. I don't know.
I think
why.
The Pasadena one's better because it's bigger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Son of is okay. They just really maximize the smaller space, so it's pretty tight.
Okay. gotcha.
You're like wall to wall with monsters and cosplayers, and that's fun and everything, but it gets a little old after a while.
Well, we're
and
not
we
bashing
just did Midsummer
Son of...
Scream for the first time.
Oh, okay.
Which was incredible.
Yeah,
it,
yeah.
It kind of blew the doors off of Monsterpalooza, but we love them both, but Midsummer Scream was just a surprise that we did not expect. It's much bigger.
Where is it? Where's Midsummer Scream? I don't know that I've even heard of that one.
It's at the Long Beach Convention Center.
Oh,
and they
okay.
up like three floors of
oh,
that convention
really?
Center. And if you've ever been there, it's a really nice convention center.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's huge.
Yeah.
We were just back there for Long Beach Comic Con, and which was not very good. And yeah, they couldn't even fill up half of the main floor space, whereas Midsummer Scream was three floors completely full of events, haunted houses, live performances, fashion shows, monster cosplay contests. Yeah, I mean, it was incredible. And it's a really lively crowd. They must promote the hell out of it, because every day there's lines both ways around the block.
Really?
And it's not like they're sharing the convention center with another event, which Long Beach Comic Con was.
Yeah.
Midsummer Scream takes the whole place. And it was incredible. We actually, from, you know, like the business side of things, we did better there than at any other event ever.
Oh,
than
we've wow. Ever, wow.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I've been thinking about just for like my art and stuff. Cause every once in a while I'll do like a little horror thing and be like, maybe I should do more of this, because it seems like the horror community, like in general, not necessarily starve for stuff, but like really goes out and supports, I think. Right.
They do. They yeah. do. And they're also, they seem to be, I mean, let me couch that for a second. We use really good artists for our cover art, that if you're a horror fan, you might recognize, you know, in the Comic-Con sort of sphere, people are generally, they're into the comics they're into. They're into their Marvel, their DC, or whatever it is that their specific, you know, fandom is. Sure. So it's a bit of a harder sell for us, because we're not in the superhero niche, and we're the horror, you know, world, and they've never heard of us. So there's definitely more of an uphill battle there. Yeah. But at the horror cons, when they see the artwork, some people will beeline across aisles once they see our banners, because they'll be like, is that Emmanuel Taglietti? Or did you just get AI to do an Emmanuel Taglietti illustration?
Oh, really?
No, we don't use AI. We use the real man. He's still alive.
That's awesome.
And then they get really excited. They're like, wow, you got an original Emmanuel Taglietti? And for listeners who don't know, he's a famous Italian illustrator. He used to be a set designer for Fellini. And then he got into illustration, and he started doing comic book covers in the 70s and 80s for all these really sexy gothic horror comics and crime comics in Italy called Fumetti's. They call them Fumetti's.
Yeah.
And he did a ton of cover art for that. And he's sort of been rediscovered in the last decade or so. And big collection of his book has been published and been reprinted several times. Sex and Horror, The Art of Emmanuel Taglietti.
Yeah.
And there's another book in the works in Italy that we're going to contribute some of the work he's done for us to that book, another collection.
Oh, nice.
So it's kind of interesting seeing the difference of the reactions, you know?
Yeah.
Because in the horror crowd, they embrace new things.
Yeah.
Of course, they have their fandoms too, you know, like,
of course,
they like their Chucky, or they like their Jason, or
yeah,
they like,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
Freddy Krueger. And you see a lot
zombies.
Of art.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, zombies. You see a lot of art that just caters to those fandoms, you know.
Sure.
But they generally seem to be more open to like our demonstration. You know, we show them the book, we give them our spiels, and you know, they love the flip book technology that we, as we call it, where you have a cover, you have two stories in one book. It's a diabolic double feature.
Yeah, yeah.
Side, you've got the Professor Dario Bava story, and then you flip it over, and on the other side, you've got a supernatural spaghetti western, Gringo Loco.
Yeah.
And people love that. It was such a simple idea we thought of a way to kind of piggyback a new IP on Professor Dario Bava.
Yeah.
And it really makes an impression with people, especially the horror cons, because they're like, whoa, you know, like,
yeah,
not all of them are total comic book, you know, people. So there's I think comic book people are a little more familiar with flip books. They're not that common anymore, but I think they used to be a little bit more.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, so, wait, let's go back and talk about what this is, because I mean, this may be somebody's first time like listening to your interview. And I mean, the one thing that I want to get across is that A, these books are a little bit larger, like you said, than the usual book. And to me, they're kind of like a throwback to like those old horror magazines, or even the Marvel oversized like Conan books that they used to do.
Oh, right.
Like
yeah.
back in the day, or Eerie. Like Eerie. Yeah. I don't know if you remember that. And it's yep. just like that, it's that size and that sort of like quality package that you guys are putting out, right? Like, just so people know, like that's what you're selling here.
Yeah. And they're full color versus a yeah. lot of the horror anthologies from back in the day that inspire us. And, you know, like Eerie and Creepy, they were anthologies that had black and white stories inside. Ours are full color stories on sort of like art book paper. Like, we use a nicer paper than newsprint. So we really try to make them quality, because the dimensions that I got that I decided on for the first book came from, you know, all the Corbin books that I had, where his compilations of, like, I think it's like the Arabian Nights or stuff like that, you know, Sinbad books, and his werewolf book, Richard Corbin, I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
American illustrator, did a lot of crazy stuff for
Amazing
heavy metal.
Illustrator. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And his books had that kind of format, you know, because they're kind of wider pages, and it really features the art more. And his were all full color as well.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my inspiration for doing it that way, because I wanted it to feel like an art book. I wanted it to feel substantial, because they're expensive to make like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have a higher price point that you have to convince people is sort of worth it. And that's why we want to deliver quality books every time. I have a story I can tell you when we're off the air about something that just happened in regards to quality that was very, very upsetting. But
Oh no. Yeah. Well, we get to discuss that later. But I mean, I think that's also probably why horror fans might be open to this sort of thing, because of those older, like, magazine quality, like Eerie and, you know, stuff like that, the magazine size, that we were kind of like, I remember when I was a kid, I would see that stuff on the newsstand. That's how old I am. Newsstands, comics used to be on newsstands. And, you know, they, like, the covers were like really like compelling and stuff like that. But I remember the price point was kind of like always like, well, do I buy my Alpha Flight or, you know, and Captain America, or do I go for this? Like, they were a little bit like out of range, but I was always like fascinated by them because the covers were so beautiful. So, like, that's another thing to stress. Like, if you have not seen the covers that these guys are putting on their books, I mean, that's worth the price of admission. I mean, they're almost like movie posters. Like, you know, it's gorgeous stuff.
Yeah, thanks, man. We really, you know, have gotten lucky with the artists, and that's, you know, to the credit of my partner Dan Simpson, who researches. He's a big fan of a lot of that art from that period.
Yeah.
So he's literally researched, you know, which guys are still working, which guys are still alive, even, you know, and has progressively reached out to different artists to gauge their interest. And the new book we have actually a newer artist. He's not from that period. Robert Samlin did the new cover for Orgy of the Blood Freaks too. And he's doing a lot of work right now. He's doing poster art and
sure.
DVD and Blu-ray packaging covers for like Vinegar Syndrome and Severin. And like, he's doing some really amazing artwork that is totally related to like that grindhouse period of movies, all these movies getting re-released. He's doing these really great and sort of dynamically designed covers, and he'll do the entire packaging. And we got him to do the cover for Orgy 2, and it's pretty amazing. We did posters of them too that were bringing out to comic shops. We did a little comic shop run last week and posted a video of that. And we're going to put up some posters today at the signing I'm doing in Ventura.
Nice.
But people really respond to the poster too. They're like, oh, wow, that's cool. Yeah. Very Halloween. Let's put it in the window. You know,
that's awesome.
What you want to hear.
Yeah. Well, October's coming. It'll be here before you know it. Like, I can't believe we're already in early September. I'm like, what is going on? Like, yeah, but yeah, I mean, so I don't know if we discussed this last time, but it must be like an investment, right? Like, these artists must be pricey to make your book, especially someone from like back in the day, right? Like that must.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think people would be surprised that a lot of times in the current world of comics, like, a lot of artists don't even really get paid up front. There's a thing called like creator owned. And okay. what a writer or a producer of the book, usually the writer is the guy who's kind of producing it or assembling the team, or he has a partner.
Yeah.
They will offer people sort of like a percentage of the sales of the book because it's going to go out under Image or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But a company like Image won't even pay the artist anything up front.
Yeah.
And that's why you see so many crowdfunding campaigns on Kickstarter that are going to actually be released by a major, you know, publisher.
Yeah.
But they're a publisher that you've heard of at least. And they'll even say in the copy of the context of the campaign that they're doing this to raise money to pay the actual artist.
Yeah.
So because the residual thing is tough, you know, and Diamond's, if you're using Diamond as a distributor, you're losing half your money pretty much out of the gate, at least. So you, in our case, we're independent. We're not, we don't have a major distributor behind us. So really we pay people up front.
Yeah.
So it is expensive. And that's for us, the crowdfunding is kind of do or die because it's, we really need, we want to pay the artists. We don't want to make them wait or have them hanging on because then you also have problems with production where it's like they get a paying gig in the middle of your gig. And they're like, ah, guys, I really need to take this job, you know, like, and we would understand that, but that's why we pay them too, is just to make sure that we can get the work, you know?
Yeah.
And then somebody like Emmanuel Taglietti, who's semi-retired, but still working very hard and getting lots of commissions.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's probably our most expensive artist to work with for, cause we want the painted covers. We want him to do his whole thing, you know, we're not asking for, you know, like, oh, just kick, you know, do something quick for us. No, we want the full Emmanuel Taglietti treatment.
Yeah.
So that's what he didn't come back on this one just for financial reasons.
Sure, sure.
We've done two covers with him, but we did secure him for the final book of this double feature trilogy.
Yeah.
He's already on board to do that, the cover for that. Oh, that's great. So one of the covers for that. But the other cover on this issue is also Vicente Alcazar, who does the inside art for Gringo Loco and was one of the original artists for Eerie and Vampirella and Jonah Hex and Creepy and all those 70s and 80s magazines, not comics rather, and, you know, anthology magazine style comics.
Yeah.
And he did the inks for this Gringo Loco cover, and I actually colored the whole cover.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of a little joint project there, which was really fun to do. And it was great when we were done because he totally, you know, gave me the greatest compliment he's ever given me, which is basically three words. Great coloring job.
Yeah, that's great.
Point.
That's awesome. That's great. I didn't know you were a colorist as well.
That really hit me.
I'm sure it did. I didn't know you were a colorist as well.
Oh yeah, I color both books.
That's right.
That's a lot of the sort of the production time.
Sure.
Because I'm writing and then I'm working with the artist directly, and then I'm getting the finished pages in. My partner Ian Mackey, Diabolic sort of producer and editor, he does color flatting.
Okay.
And then I get the pages and I'm coloring both books.
Nice.
Photoshop? And I do them totally differently too. I use a totally different sort of style and technique with them to keep them different. Cause I don't want them to look sort of the same. They have different palettes and things. So, but it was exciting to get Vicente's approval.
That's great. Worried.
He wouldn't like how I colored his cover, you know, cause it's all his inks and everything. But he was really pleased with it, you know, so.
Oh, that's great. That's awesome. That's awesome. So, I mean, I would imagine these covers are worth the investment because, I mean, it seems like people are going crazy for them. And for that's one of the things for sure where I was just like, oh my gosh, like these things look like, I mean, I can't stress it enough for anyone who's not seen them. They are definitely the thing that sucks you in. And if you're able to reproduce them as posters and stuff to get to comic shops, like that must be worth its weight in gold as well, right?
Yeah. Oh, well, we hope so. We just got some out. It's really hard to tell when any one promotion you know, actually leads to.
Yeah.
But we try to tag all of our links and our QR codes so that we can do sort of the basic tracking within Kickstarter.
Yeah.
But it's really just presence. You know, we want people to know that it's there. And if it looks like something you're interested in, check it out, because you probably won't be disappointed. We, you know, on this campaign, we also included a lot of like the great comments we've gotten, not just from like reviewers, but from our fans who we've met at events and people who took time to write to us and tell us what they thought of the books. And so if you check out our Kickstarter page, you'll see a lot of testimonials. They're all credited too. It's not one of those things where we just put some nice thing in quotes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which I just saw a page where somebody did that. I'm like, ah.
Oh, really? You really
should do that. Yeah, you should really attribute them, even if it's just to Bob, backer of
you know. Yeah, yeah, or Twitter, like the thing they started doing for movie reviews, you know, years ago. They were like, quote unquote, Twitter. I'm like, what does that mean? That could be like anybody. Well, this book definitely, this stuff definitely gets my seal of approval, because I've very much enjoyed them from the beginning and just been like, it's been such a pleasure, because, you know, they're just such a throwback to like when horror was, I mean, it's different than it is today. Now it's all the sort of like, you know, I don't mean to knock like current horror or anything like that. I just watched something called The Black Phone the other day on Amazon and actually really liked it. But I mean,
I like that one too.
Yeah, yeah. I thought it was pretty good. I like Ethan Hawke, like as an actor, you know, like he's kind of like, to me, like a quality dude. So I was like, all right, let me check that out.
In that were great too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. 100%. The little girl and the little boy, you know, who preteen, I say little girl and little boy, but you know, yeah. I'm a parent. That's how I see. But, but I mean, it's a different era of horror and, you know, I mean, obviously the title alone, like, you know, Dario Bava, Professor Dario Bava, but we haven't talked about like what this is about. This is what we're getting into the weeds on covers. And for anybody who hasn't been exposed to your stuff or know what it is, Orgy of the Blood Freaks. I mean, it pretty much like says it all. And then you've got Gringo Loco, which I love. I love a good Western. And then you mix it in with horror. What are these books kind of like about for people who are not, you know, who have not been exposed to them?
Well, good question.
are you still trying to figure Professor it out? Is that what you're telling me?
Professor Dario Bava is kind of our Van Helsing or Doctor Who, or he's our kind of heroic character in his own mind and sort of in his own time.
Yeah.
It's the stories of Orgy of the Blood Freaks take place in Rome, 1967. And Professor Dario Bava, paranormal playboy in quotations, was a top Vatican exorcist until he turned on, tuned in, and dropped out to fight monsters and stick it to the man.
Yeah.
And he enlists the aid of this hip young nun, Sister Sadie, to investigate this creepy haunted abbey ruins where his former assistant was murdered by supernatural forces of psychedelic proportions. And it's very much a throwback to a lot of Hammer Gothic films from the early 70s and European horror in general, which was kind of sexier. And the Italian stuff, like the Giallo films, which was the Black Gloved Killers. We have a lot of those elements all kind of thrown into this mixing pot of a story, which makes it very fun. It's kind of a romp.
Yeah.
With a lot of like serious elements intermixed with sort of fun and goofing off type stuff. Not Austin Powers, though people have said it kind of reminds them of like
that's
a more intense horror version of Austin Powers.
Yeah.
Because it is kind of groovy and fun like that. But it's not the slapstick type of thing. It is really its own thing. I was never even really thinking of Austin Powers writing it.
Yeah, I didn't think of it when I read it, but anyway, Austin Powers is not something that is in the forefront of my mind in general. So
because it's the 60s.
Yeah,
groovy. Yeah, I can dig it, kind of dialogue and lingo.
Yeah.
But to me, it's a love letter to those films, and it's a way to kind of modernize some of those stories in a fun way. that kind of keeps them alive. And they're chock full of monsters, these stories. You know, like, we made up a new monster for this series that we really love, that the readers are going to get to see more of. They only saw a tease of the monster in book one. In book two, we kind of like overshow it, but
yeah,
but that, to explain it and kind of get people on board with this crazy creature. And book two is just, I'm so excited about book two of Professor Dario Baba. But let me just segue to Gringo Loco.
Yeah.
Gringo Loco is a totally different vibe. It's again, sort of inspired by Italian cinema, but more the spaghetti westerns of, you know, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, or Django, the original Django.
Yeah, yeah.
Where you have like a man of mystery who we don't really know that much about. And we slowly get to learn how dangerous they are, what they're capable of as the story unfolds.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a teaser for that. Cause Gringo Loco, as we learned in book one, is some kind of inhuman human, some kind of man that was made from pieces of other men, it looks like.
Yeah.
Is he a Frankenstein? Is he a zombie? We don't really know, but we know that he's immune to hanging. He's immune to lead poisoning, and he's sick of it all. That's our tagline in one of our promos. But that's really a fun story too, because even if you're not into Westerns, it's an archetypical sort of character who is constantly in trouble, constantly being hunted down. And, you know, even though we don't know that much about him, we, you know, as the reader, my hope is, and from what I've been told, is like you connect to this character in a very sort of personal way. And that is really exciting as a writer, because I know the entire backstory about Gringo Loco. And that's how I kind of pitched it to my business partners as like, let's get this story going too.
Yeah.
And they were very excited about his origin story. But then when it came time to write the first book, I told them, you know, I'm not going to start there. I'm going to start much later in this guy's journey, just so that we can have an exciting kind of reveal of the character in book one, and then send him out kind of on, you know, the story mission by the end of book one, which is what we did. And book two now is again, it's even bigger. It's 40 pages of story.
Nice.
And it's just nonstop kind of crazy action. And we learn even more about him. Not that much more, but we learn some really weird, horrific kind of stuff. It's a bit of a descent into hell, because we pick up like the day, the same moment that we left book one, as the sun is setting across the desert and he's chasing Cyrus Caldwell, notorious bounty killer and evil Pinkerton.
That's great. I love it.
And I don't want to spoil it, but it's really exciting. And I mean, Vicente's work on it was just awe-inspiring. He was so into it and so fast and good. I think we only had one page where we really went back and forth with thumbnails. I gave him one thumbnail early on for something, and he's like, "Oh, I like that. That's a good layout for that shot."
Uh-huh.
He calls it shots. It's funny.
I'm sure.
And then we had one page where we kind of went back and forth a little, but he mostly just goes for my scripts. Like, he just takes it, and like, I'm getting pages before I can even like start thumbnailing.
Oh, nice.
Because I write Gringo Loco differently too. I write it more stream of consciousness than I do Professor Dario Baba, because Professor Dario Baba's got a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of twists and turns, and there's a lot of, you know, there's different characters. There's a broader cast of characters and plot lines.
Yeah.
Gringo Loco is very straightforward. Like, your basic, it's basically existential action at his side, seeing what happens to this man or creature or whatever he is. And we go through that with him, and we learn things about him as we go through the adventure. So you're going to learn more in book two. And it's even more violent.
Sure. Sure. I love both of the books, but I mean, I think like Gringo Loco to me, like, just hits me And I, you know, when I was a kid, I hated Westerns. Like I hated, like I was just like boring. They would come on the TV and I would just be like, whatever, you know, Star Wars, Superman, like all that stuff. But it wasn't until I got older, like maybe late teens, early 20s, and I saw The Magnificent Seven, like I actually sat through it and I was like, holy shit, like this was good. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. And since then, if there's a Western that's good, like I tend to, you know, and then eventually, you know, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly and Once Upon a Time in the West, like all that stuff definitely like imprinted itself on my brain. So for me, like Gringo Loco, I was just like, I love this. And I'm just wondering, what are the thoughts as far as like with the Kickstarter, like leading with Orgy of the Blood Freaks rather than Gringo Loco? Is it just, I mean, Orgy of the Blood Freaks is going to suck you in no matter what, I guess, right? So any thoughts on like putting like Orgy of the Blood Freaks?
That's a really good question. That's a really good question because it is difficult to balance, because you have limits to what you can explain, you know?
Sure.
And you want to just have one title. You don't want to make it confusing.
Yeah.
And our basic thought was like, Professor Dario Bava was always the marquee character. He's the one that we've been working on the longest.
Yeah.
We've done the most stuff with that character. So he was kind of like, he's the top build in the double feature.
Yeah.
And due to the limitations of Kickstarter, you just, you know, then you say in the description that it's a double feature with Gringo Loco. And you say, you know, it's sexy Euro horror on one side.
Yeah.
Supernatural spaghetti Western on the other. And hopefully people at least go to look at the page, because on the page itself we included videos, we included interiors from both books,
yeah,
and explanations, and you know, just to get people excited about the world of Gringo Loco, because some of our best reviews are for that story. It's just that Western books in general, like Western movies, it's a smaller kind of market.
Yeah.
And even though it also has elements of horror, especially, you know, more so in book two, that is not really what it is. A straight up gritty spaghetti style Western, and by that I mean in the Italian Westerns it wasn't good guys, bad guys, it was everybody's morally sort of, you know, indifferent in a way. There's no cut and dry white hat, black hat characters. Everybody's got issues, and it's a much darker version of the West, probably a more realistic version, but also elevated to kind of mythic levels. And that's what attracted me to keeping that story, because Gringo Loco was a character, I think we talked about this last time, like I always wanted to do like kind of a Frankenstein or RoboCop type character, you
sure.
know, this man, formerly a man, now something else, now a monster, you know. We had bounced around between making it a sci-fi thing, making it, you know, current day or Western. And I just fell in love with the Western thing.
Yeah.
That version of the idea, because it is a great way to look at kind of the origins of a lot of the things that are still happening now and percolating in this country today.
Yeah.
You know, like the American West, there's a lot of that sort of, you know, depredation and sort of, you know, what we did, you know, to establish this country as it is pretty ugly. And that sort of ugliness every now and then keeps coming out in our politics and our, you know,
yeah,
you know, modern day.
Yeah.
And it's a great way to kind of like, yeah, this is why, this is kind of where it comes from. And this is how this land was kind of founded. And these are the types of people that were running around then, you know?
Yeah.
To me, it had like a resonance to today, that even though it was an old idea I had, once I started developing it for the book, I was like, oh wow. I started seeing the parallels, you know, that were current again, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was basically, it's a marketing thing, like the simplicity, because it is very difficult to figure out how to market both at the same time.
Yeah.
I did some cool animations of like drive-in double feature and did a voiceover sort of narration on the campaign pitch video to explain to people like why that was an important thing to me.
Yeah.
And you know, like when I was a kid, there were still drive-ins, and you know, when I was a teenager, we would, you know, have a friend drop us off at the cemetery next to the drive-in. We'd go to the back of the cemetery, go onto the train tracks, walk down the train tracks to the drive-in where there was a hole in the fence and crawl through there
nice.
And watch the monster double features or the Dust Till Dawn triple features and stuff like that.
Nice.
And that kind of stuck in my head, you know, like those memories are very fresh in my head because it was such a wild, fun, and scary thing to do when you're a kid, too. Oh, the cemetery. Oh, let's not get hit by the train. You know, it's just
things felt that illegal. A modern day parent would never just no. Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely not. Like, yeah, that's so funny. The stuff that we got away with is stuff that I just think of like, I would never let my daughter do that. Like, never in a million years. Like, what? Kind of insanity.
Well, my parents didn't know we were doing that.
yeah, I know. No, but I mean, like, we would be off running around, like, doing whatever, right? And, like, yeah. No one would know. Like, now it's like, I mean, maybe it's part of, like, living in LA, but, like, that's part of the, you know, reason I was rushing to get to this interview. It's like, I had to take my daughter to a Girl Scout meeting, and it's like, I gotta run back, and I know exactly where she is, and I gotta go pick her up at a certain time. Like, that was not the way it was when we were kids.
No.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I was a total latchkey kid. Both my parents
too.
Worked. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's so funny. So would you say that was, like, I don't know if we ever, like, really discussed it in our first interview, but, like, what was the thing that got you sucked into horror? Was it going to those drive-in things and like seeing that, or was it previous to that? Because I don't know about you, but when I was younger, when I was a, you know, teenager and stuff, I didn't really get into horror until I got older, but I was a fraidy cat. Like I didn't want to watch any of that stuff. Like I have a very distinct memory of going to see Poltergeist. I've mentioned this several times on the podcast. And once the shit hits the fan and the clown doll starts, my uncle had to drag me out of the theater kicking and screaming because I was just like, oh my God. Like I lost my shit. Like I lost my shit like a kid would, you know what I mean? Because my uncle, who I love dearly, was that cool uncle who took you to see like Conan the Barbarian, which is another very distinct movie memory where I was like, I don't know if I should be watching this right now, but it's amazing. Like, you know what I mean? So what were some of like, what is the thing that got you like really into horror? Was it those memories of like sneaking into, you know, a drive-in or was it before that?
Partially, but I was a little older then, but I have been into it much earlier. And my parents were kind of like your cool uncle. Like I saw The Shining in the theater.
Oh, wow.
And Poltergeist in the theater. And it was like, whoa. But my parents knew by that time that I was into it because Saturday mornings, instead of watching cartoons and stuff like that, I usually watched like Creature Double Feature.
Nice.
They were like the channels from New York, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Upstate New York. They would do like old Hammer horror double features or Universal monster double features on the weekends.
Yeah.
And I would watch those and I just loved them. I always kind of, you know, when I was even younger, I loved dinosaurs, you know, I just loved monsters and, you know, the idea of the supernatural and crazy creatures coming to get you kind of thing. So they knew that I was kind of conditioned to it. Yeah. And they took me to see Alien when it first came out.
Oh
too.
My God.
I was really young.
I have a very distinct memory of Alien, like being like when VHS like first came out, that's how old I am, folks. Like being ferried, like my family watching the VHS of Alien and being ferried between the living room and like to one of the bedroom, like don't let Christian see it. Like, you know, like very like rushed, like rush him through. Like they were all watching, obviously they could have paused it or whatever, but like everyone was watching it. And this is a different uncle's apartment and just being rushed through the living room, like get him through. So I can't imagine like being young and seeing like Alien, like in the theater, I probably would have had a trauma. Like it just like literally like when Grease came out again, this is how old I am. They had the trailer of The Omen right before. And it freaked me out. And when Grease was so popular when it came out that, you know, you would go see it again and again because there wasn't like VHS at that point.
Right.
And I had to wait out in the lobby so that I wouldn't see the trailer for The Omen before Grease. Like that's how scared I was. Like, and now I love horror movies. So the idea of being a little kid and seeing like Alien, like I would just lose my shit. Like it would just be crazy. I can't imagine.
It was, It was a different time, you know.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
They were also taking me to Woody Allen movies and stuff.
Oh, I was taken to Wood. I was taken to Broadway Danny Rose when I was a kid, and I was like, "Why is this in black and white? Like, what is?" And finding it strangely compelling. I mean, obviously, he turned out to be a creep or whatever, but like being interested in it even as a kid, like, what is going on? Like, so weird. Oh my God, that's so funny.
Well, he was like the intellectual auteur of filmmaking back then, before he was pariah, you know. He and it was like all the smart people went to go check out his movies. And you know, and my parents, you know, were into that, and you know, I got to, I mean, I didn't like Annie Hall the first time I saw it in a theater.
Yeah.
But later on I watched it again, I'm like, oh wow, that is pretty great, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's just all over my head, you know. Yeah. So much of it.
Yeah.
I liked when he turned and talked to the camera, because I thought that was funny.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was a kid, but the rest of it, no idea what the hell was going on.
Yeah, I just remember really, because I grew up in Jersey and New York and on the East Coast. And the thing that I remember the most is just so many movies were in New York City. And I just remember loving that, like just being like, oh, yeah, it's in New York. Like, this feels like I belong there. Like I could be in there somewhere, like wandering around on a subway, like with my parents, or, you know what I mean? Or my grandma or something. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? And it was just always a thing. Like when Superman, the movie came out, and Metropolis was like literally New York. I was like, that's New York. Like, I've been to that place. Like, you know, like I've been to that building where the Daily Planet, like, it just freaked me the fuck out. Like, you know what I mean? So yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah, that's great. So
I had the same feelings, you know, like, because I didn't live in the city yet until I was older, but I lived in upstate, and we would go down to the city to go to museums or whatever, check out shows, you know, like everybody does. But it was a sense of like, oh wow, yeah, this world, you could almost touch it, like you were part of the movie, or you know, like it gave it a sense of familiarity. And like, you know, that first Superman movie too was like, you know, that was like Star Wars to our generation.
Yeah.
You know, and it was another big one that was like, wow, you saw that again and again kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's so great. So your parents were the ones that kind of got you into horror, or they knew that you were into it, so they were cool with taking you to horror movies.
Yeah, for sure.
Nice, nice. But you don't remember the trigger, like the thing that set you off. Like, you don't remember like the first horror movie that you saw. Do you remember that at all, or?
No, I just remember the obsession with the monsters, the dinosaurs, and then, you know, even like I kept an old fairy tale book that my parents had, and it was an illustrated fairy tale book, you know, kind of a big thick one with a lot of the, you know, the grim kind of fairy tales in it with illustrations.
Yeah,
and there were scary illustrations in that were my favorite illustrations as a kid.
Yeah.
And the Disney movies that had, you know, monstrous villains, you know, I think was Sleeping Beauty, where there's a dragon.
Sleeping Beauty, Maleficent.
Yeah. There's those were always my favorite parts of those movies, and I would always talk about the monsters. So it was kind of just a general progression of my interest in those kind of things. Dark fantasy, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah.
Because I would say that too about like Professor Dario Bava, in terms of the type of horror it is, it's more of like dark fantasy. It's more gothic it's not like a serial killer chopping people up kind of story, although people do get mutilated. but it's more playing with the ideas and the fantasy elements of monsters, and what it means to be a monster, and who says if you're a monster or not, or what creates a monster, kind of those ideas is like, I'm sort of making it sound boring or over intellectual.
No, actually that stuff,
but that's what makes it, I think, fun. And that's why people respond to like the writing in the books too. Like, I do get compliments on the, you know, the art we get complimented on all the time, but we do get compliments on the writing, because I do take a lot of care to like have these stories sort of have stuff in it that you can really sink your teeth into conceptually, so that, you know, it's entertaining on that level as well.
Yeah.
You know? Cause it's funny. I mean, even when I was a kid, I didn't always read all my comics, you know, like I would look at the pictures a lot of the time and be inspired by that.
Oh, that's interesting.
But, and I'm aware that, you know, people, I have friends who got our book, who supported our campaigns, haven't read anything yet. And I'm like, dude, it's going to take you 10 minutes.
Yeah. Not if you read comics like I did. Like my daughter's into comics, like, and lately she's busy in school and stuff like that in high school. So she's not reading as much as she used to when she was younger, but like she zips through stuff, and I would literally sit for like, people would be like, you're not done with that yet. And I would be like, cause I love the art, but I would just be looking at the panels. Like I would be like staring at the panels, and I'm still kind of that way too now, like, because I'm an artist in my own free time and stuff like that. And so like, I'm just always like fascinated by like how people do stuff, and especially having a knowledge of like digital art and knowing how it works and things like that. And I'm still like looking at stuff and like analyzing it and being like, what is that? So like my daughter will be like, you're still not done with that yet? And I'll be like, well, you know, it's not like I'm mentally slow or anything. I'm just like, I'm enjoying it. I totally get what you're saying. Like you could zip through it, but I'm that type of fan that will like sit with the comic and just be like, you know, and people will be like, you're not done with that yet? And I'm just like, I'm in it, man. Like I'm trying to enjoy, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that is more like me, because I love the art.
Yeah.
You know, if it's I have to really like the art to get that into it. But then if I do, like, yeah, I study the art, you know, like I love looking at composition, how they use color, and you know, like when it's really good, you really it really tells a lot of the story too. And that's something that I think of as when I'm coloring as well, is like, that's my last chance to kind of underline what's important in the story, is with the color and how I shade things and where I put the emphasis, where I'm drawing people's eye to things. So that's kind of one of the things I personally love about the medium of, you know, of comics is, and, you know, visual storytelling, is just that fact that it does take a while to finish the projects, but each step is kind of a way to focus it more and to add another level of like understanding, or another sort of piece of the puzzle for the attentive reader or the attentive, you know, person like yourself who is going to be studying the art. Like there, we put details into that stuff. We think about that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I have to go back and forth with Mike Dubish about that stuff sometimes, because he'll be like, oh, that's important. I didn't think you know.
No,
you got to have that in there, man.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
I don't think anybody's going to get that. I'm like, I don't care. Just put it in there.
Yeah. I am definitely like, even, and I should say, like, even when the art to me is not great and I get a book and I'm looking at it, I just like, I'm like, okay, this has a fan base. Like somebody's into this. Why? Like, how did this get a fan? Like who's into this? Like, how does it work? Like, why does it work? Like, because I don't know about you, but I definitely see comic art sometimes where I'm like, okay, like this is to me, like not as impressive as something else. Why does this have a larger fan base than, you know, this or whatever? Why is this attracting attention more than, you know, the other thing? And so it's just like, I just am always just looking at stuff and being like, wow, how did this work? Like, what is it that people, and then, you know, you're an artist too, like you're a filmmaker, you know, and things like that. And so for me, it's like, I'm also looking at what is the appeal of the thing that I'm looking at? You know what I mean? Like that sort of thing. And so it's interesting. It's always interesting for me to just like look at, and I will get into the weeds and get lost and stuff. And it's bad. Sometimes I'm just like, just finish it. Just like get done with it.
That's what's great about the books too. Like just the, having a nice book that you can return to. And that's what I love about books in general. I mean, most of the books I have are either comic related or art and film related.
Yeah.
And they're full of like pictures and, you know, design stuff. I have books about design from the 60s that helps me kind of put together the world of Dario Bava. You know, like I have all kinds of references and things that I refer to. And I love that about books. And like, if we were going to put out a book, that I wanted it to be something that people would be able to put on their shelves proudly and be able to look at and show to people and be like, look how cool this thing is, you know, because that's kind of the cool thing about it. And I, you know, like it feels like it's sort of a dying medium, but I don't think it'll ever die. Digital hasn't really totally replaced it yet. Sure, my mom reads on her Kindle all the time.
Yeah.
She was never into comics to begin with. So.
Yeah, you're not going to turn her. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's yeah. My mom too. Yeah, she's not into that stuff either. But one of the things that I wanted to mention too, for anybody that's never heard of these, like it's funny because a lot of this stuff or a lot of your tastes are like it's a giallo, right? Is that how we pronounce it? Like the sort of like giallo, like era of like horror, right? Like the Italian
stuff.
Yeah,
that was the Italian kind of like murder mysteries where it was a mysterious serial killer with black gloves.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah. And a lot of that stuff is known for its like gore, its blood and stuff like that. And I remember the last time or when I finally got my hands on a lot of the books, I was like, this isn't like over the top. Like, you know what I mean? Like it's got elements of supernatural. It's got elements of horror and stuff like that. It's funny to me how like, and I don't know about this second edition that you've come out with, but at least in the first edition, I remember being like, oh, like I could show this to just about anybody who's a horror fan. You know what I mean? Because I mean, obviously it's like, let's say like somebody who likes Poltergeist is not going to love like a giallo movie. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But like this covers the span of like, it's not going to freak anybody out too much. And I think that what you did was a really nice balance because anybody who likes horror or is interested in kind of like supernatural stuff, you don't tip the boat over too much. You know what I'm saying? And I thought that was a good aspect. Have you ever gotten any comments on that?
Not specifically, but thank you for that. Yeah, I don't want it to just be, although we use a lot of the trappings of exploitation films, like title, Orgy of the Blood Freaks is like an exploitation film title. It's got orgy and blood in it. But that's just kind of, it's
and
almost
sexy nuns.
A little too much of an inside joke, because I think maybe the title does turn some people away. But
sure.
It's really, that's just kind of like an inside joke because the book itself, the story itself, is not total exploitation. It's,
it's
kind of more progressive in that way.
Yeah.
Like we're not, it's not a bunch of sexist misogyny and chopping women up and, you know, it's not that kind of exploitation. It's more of the fantasy stuff. It's more of the fun ideas. It's more of like, imagine if there was a world where all this stuff existed. How crazy would that be?
Yeah.
And I do try to keep it a little bit on that level. I don't want it to be mean. I don't want it to be mean spirited, you know, which I think a lot of slasher films and more modern horror has like a nastiness to it that is kind of cruel.
Sure.
And the world of Professor Dario Bava doesn't really have that. It does mix in the book, in the second book, it does mix a little bit more sexuality with horror and those ideas. And there is some pretty savage stuff in the introduction. Not dwelled upon, but we realize that, orphans at this abbey are being sacrificed. And that's, you know, depending on your point of view, that's pretty scary and pretty, you know, pretty over the top. But we don't like dwell on that. And we don't show any explicitly.
You mean there's people that wouldn't find orphans being sacrificed disturbing? I don't want to meet those people.
There's different ways you could do it.
Sure.
You
know? Absolutely. Like, absolutely. I know what you're talking about.
You could dwell on it and show like a dissection of an orphan, or you can just,
that's,
you know, give it a one shot turn page, shocking image, and then you move on.
That's interesting. Because we mentioned,
I don't want it to be that kind of a book.
Yeah, you know? Got it. Yeah,
that's
not
my. I know I got to deliver on those kind of things, and it's one of those weird things where you do have to think up, you know, creative ways to kill people.
Yeah, sure. It's
so
all
sort
been
of
done
become
before.
A little demented in the process, I guess.
One way or another. Yeah. It's funny because I was scrolling through your Kickstarter page, and it's I noticed that the blood is fine, the violence is fine, but you got to cover up the naughty bits of the. I'm like, really? Like, come on. Yeah. Is this where we are in our culture? It's just so funny to me. It's so messed up.
That's America. Yeah. If it was Europe, I don't think it would be as big of a deal, but here it's definitely, you gotta cover that stuff up.
That's so funny. That's so funny.
I think it's hilarious too. You know, I think of the two, Gringo Loco probably has there's more, you know, mean sort of, not mean, but because everybody who kind of gets it deserves it, almost everybody.
Yeah.
But there is like a more of a dwelling on the violence kind of part of that, because that's part of that story. Yeah. This is a character who was forged in violence and yeah. whose only recourse is violence, who has nothing else to offer the world. And it's a violent world. And so that's got a darker kind of tone. That's if you're looking more, which is, I think, the balance that people like about the double feature, at least the first one, is that they're different. You know, they're not, you know, they're written by the same guy, but they're totally different sides of the coin, you know. And they're written and colored by the same dude.
Yeah. No,
you know.
Well, I mean, you know, all of it is great, and I love all of it, and I'm just always, you know, really appreciative of the stuff that you're doing, because there is not a lot of stuff out there like this, you know what I mean? And I remember the first time I was exposed to it, I was like, yes. I remember getting the email, and I was like, yes, please. You know what I mean? And that's the thing, is like, I'm not, like, I love horror, but I'm not as much an expert as, you know, the people that go to conventions or other people that I've had on my podcast. I haven't seen everything, because like I've mentioned on this podcast before, I do share the TV with my family. Even Black Phone was like a controversial choice with my wife. She's like, no, I'm not watching this. She's like, I can't deal with children being kidnapped. And I'm like, I get it. I was like that when my daughter was first born. But then the next day, she was just, spoilers for anybody who has not seen Black Phone yet, she was like, does the kid escape? And I was like, yes. I was like, yes, he gets out. Like, you don't have to worry about that. She's like, that's all I needed to know. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
No, I love the relationship between the brother and sister.
Like, oh, yeah. That, so good.
That
so,
really made that movie.
It really
work
did.
For me. It felt like, and they didn't, and it wasn't like overly PC. Like, they made it feel like the 70s where the story took place. Well, and there's kids swearing, and there's
there's and all beating kinds the of shit like, out of each other, like
beating each other,
and the other thing too, and you know, not to diverge onto Black Phone too much, but the one thing that I will say, and what it relates to what we were talking about before, there is literally somebody going around the neighborhood kidnapping kids. And the brother and sister are like split up after school because she's got a sleepover. And she's like, yeah, I'm going to go to the sleepover, walk the streets by me. That would never happen. I mean, I don't care like what, even in the 70s, like in 80s, we were smart enough to be like, if somebody's running around kidnapping kids, we pair up. You know what I mean? Like, it's just not going to happen. That was one of the things in the movie where I was like, no, the brother would not let the sister walk to the sleepover by herself. It's just not going to fucking happen. Where there's a
strong dad energy from.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying, like, come on, admit it, right? Yeah. If there was somebody going, like, even when we were kids, it would be like, no, dude, I will walk you to the thing. And you know what I mean? Like, we'll go together.
That was a little unbelievable because they knew it was going on.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And it was in the news, and all the kids were freaked out about it.
And one of their friends had already disappeared.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. I liked the movie otherwise, but I was like, no, that little detail for me, I was like, and unfortunately, I'm that kind of movie TV fan that is like looks at the little things, and I'm like, no, absolutely not. But
movies like you read comics.
Yeah,
you
know, exactly.
Pay attention to the details.
Which drives my family kind of crazy sometimes. But at sometimes my daughter's like, well done, father. And I'm like, all right, nice. But we're not here to talk about Black Phone. We've been talking about Professor Dario Bava, Orgy of the Blood Freaks 1 and 2, which is currently available on Kickstarter. Sir Phil Mucci, I appreciate you coming back onto my podcast. That's what it is, a podcast. It's a Sunday morning. So again, any final thoughts on this? Or because I know you have to go to a signing. You're Mr. Busy Pants, Mr. The busiest man in the comic business. Any final thoughts, or where can people find you online? Let the people know.
Well, final thoughts, just, you know, please check out the campaign if you like it. You know, any kind of support is helpful. Yeah. It's really a gauge of, like, you know, how far we can keep going with this project.
Sure.
And you can find out a lot on the campaign page on Kickstarter. Just look it up. Orgy. If you just type in Orgy, it'll pop up, honestly.
I would hope so.
There's not a lot of
Orgy. The way Kickstarter is these days, it's like, oh, I'm sure there could be another Orgy book out there.
We have a website, ProfessorDarioBava.com. And then on Instagram, you can find us at Diabolic LLC. That's Diabolic with a K.
Yep.
And same on Facebook. We're not really on Twitter anymore.
You're one of the few, Everyone's still on Twix. That's what I'm calling it these days. Twitter Twix.
Triple X Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. Well, good for you, sir. Anyway, I mean, this is currently on Kickstarter, Professor Dario Bava. I love these books. I think they're so much fun. As a fan of horror, as a fan of the supernatural, as a fan of comic books, I just think they're fun. So, you know, if you're into this type of thing, and even if you're not, just check it out, because I really love your stuff, Phil. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Continuing to come back onto the podcast.
My pleasure.
And again, the gentleman's name is Phil Mucci, as in House of Gucci. The project is Professor Dario Bava, or House of, don't even get me started on that movie. Professor Dario Bava, Orgy of the Blood Freaks 1 and 2, currently on Kickstarter. My name is Christian Horn. This has been another episode of the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You can check us out on parttimefanboy.com. We are on Facebook. We are on Instagram. We are no longer on the hellscape that is Twix, Twitter X. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening. Please go support this Kickstarter, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.